UFC President Dana White spoke to Aaron Bronstetter of TSN, and a couple of the topics he covered were Nate Diaz and Kayla Harrison, and I want to talk about both those things briefly here and point out that, you know, White is more or less gaslighting and just being full of shit, for a lack of a better term. And here's what he had to say about Nate Diaz and the possibility that Nate Diaz is going to fight out of his UFC contract. Diaz has one fight left in his current UFC deal, and seeing what the options are for him out there. And White, never missing an opportunity to gaslight someone, is doing that to Nate Diaz here. And here's what he had to say. That's a decision he needs to make. Listen, for a lot of these guys, there's no secret about it. If you believe that you're one of the best in the world and you believe you can win the world title here or hang with the top five, then this is where you should be. The minute you start doubting that's the case, you got to start looking at other options. That's not what what's going on here in the least. White's avoiding the real issue and trying to make Diaz look like he's washed up. We know Diaz is one of the handful of fighters who is a draw in the UFC. With the UFC, can just put Nate Diaz on a card, and that card will draw more than your average card. It's just the way it is. Nate Diaz is, Dana White like it or not, a needle mover. And so Nate Diaz knows he's a needle mover. Nate Diaz knows his value. Nate Diaz wants to be paid what he's worth. And the UFC, as a business, never wants to pay any fighter what he's worth or even close to what they're worth. And so what's happening here is Diaz is exploring his options, looking to where he's going to get paid the most, and Dana White, knowing that he is never going to pay Diaz what he's worth or what Diaz wants, is starting to drive down, or trying to drive down, Diaz's value as a fighter and as a legitimate contender. Diaz might not be a legitimate contender. He's not. I don't think he is a legitimate contender. But what he is a fighter who fans want to see. And as such, he's a fighter who needs to get paid what he deserves. And the UFC's business does not allow for that. Never will. And that's what we're seeing here. Dana White's trying to gaslight Nate Diaz and trying to trick the fans into thinking that Diaz is washed up. He's not. He just wants what he deserves, and the UFC does not want to pay that. So that's what we're doing here. And in the same kind of vein, Kayla Harrison with the PFL, she's making $1 million over there just to truck people, and fine. But with the idea that she might be interested in coming to the UFC, White is trying to tell her that she's not worthy. And this is a different kind of trick here. This is the trick where he tells someone they're not worthy, and then they, Kayla Harrison at this point, will, in a desire to prove White wrong, join the UFC, get paid less than they're worth, just to prove Dana White wrong. And that is something that Harrison cannot allow. So here's what Dana White had to say about Kayla Harrison. Kayla Harrison's a great example. PFL pays her an obscene amount of money to fight over there. If I was her, I'd stay right there, right where she is, and keep picking off people over there. When you come here to the UFC, Amanda Nunes is no joke. Valentina Shevchenko is no joke. Rose Namajunas is no joke. These are all the best women in the world. These are the best female fighters in the world. I don't blame her. I would stay there and keep fighting the type of women she's fighting there before I would come here and fight an Amanda Nunes. This is all a trick. He's just trying to stoke Kayla Harrison's competitive fires and get her to sign with the UFC for less than she's worth. If I'm Kayla Harrison, I'm looking at this as a prize fighter. This is prize fighting. The prize is not a trinket you can buy on the UFC store for a couple $100. The prize is that big check that she's been collecting at the end of the PFL season for $1 million. The prize is money. The prize isn't some kind of idea of legacy that's useless or a UFC title that's worthless. The prize is money. Kayla Harrison should stay in PFL. Not because Dana White's dismissing her, but because she can make more money there. Simple as that. Anyone that has a chance to make $1 million in a prize fight should do so. Unless, you know, they were making $30 million, then I'm talking about MMA though. So the chance to make $1 million in MMA is slim. So if you get the opportunity to do that more than once, stay there. Keep catching that check, because the UFC is not going to pay you. Harrison is never going to make what she's making at the PFL in the UFC. It's just not the way that the place does business. And Dana White's right. He's right for the wrong reason, but he's right. Kayla Harrison should stay with the PFL, and Nate Diaz should leave the UFC, both because they can make more money outside of the UFC. And don't let Dana White try and convince you any other way. This is all about money and him not wanting to pay it. And the fighters, more and more, should start seeing where the money is and going after that money and not after the worthless UFC title. So on Monday at the weigh-ins for the Dana White Contender Series, after failing to make weight, Oran Kalon called his opponent Javed Basharat, who is from Afghanistan, a terrorist during their face-off. Basharat won the fight, so things kind of worked out the way they should have, for lack of a better term. After the fight, UFC President Dana White was asked if he or the promotion were going to do anything about the comments of Kalon, and White said, "Are we going to do anything? It got done tonight. You know what I mean? It's a beautiful thing about this sport. I say it all the time. This is not a nice sport. This is a very rough sport. We say a lot of mean things to each other, you know, and justice gets served at the end of the day. Listen, when you have a situation like that, the best way to solve the problem is you fight, and you fight legally. You get paid to do it, and that's what happened tonight." So I want you to pause for a moment and think about how stupid that statement is, because it's genuinely stupid. It's nonsensical. Things worked out. But did White know that was going to happen in advance? Of course not. It was luck. It was a luck of the draw. And what if the other fighter would have won? What if Kalon had won? And then, or seriously hurt his opponent? Would justice have been served then? No, of course not. Then White would have had to come up with another excuse of why he let this guy who made an asinine statement calling the guy a terrorist, why he let him compete? He shouldn't have let him compete. The fight should have been canceled. Kalon should have been packed off home with no money, and Basharat should have gotten paid and another opportunity to compete. Just because things worked out doesn't mean White was on the right side of this. He wasn't. All he did was tell us that calling a fighter a terrorist is not over the line for him. And that's great. So now we know where White stands. There's nothing that we know or has been said or done that is over the line for him. And that's fine. But when he added this, this is the part where I have some additional problems. Mean things are said in this insanely politically correct world we're living in. This is one place that is not. And so there's no line for Dana White. Fine. So if there's no line for White, what about Disney? What about ESPN? What about the UFC's ownership? What about the UFC stockholders? This is not the Dana White show. This is not a mom and pop concern anymore. White has a lot of people to answer to. And when he says, "You can say anything, you can do anything," somewhere in that ownership group, in the sponsors, in ESPN, in Disney, someone in the stockholders, someone's going to say, "You know what? I don't think that's true. I don't think you can say anything." And so this is a problem. And sooner or later, it's going to bite White in the ass. And for those that are saying this is some kind of brave, hands-off approach, it's not. It's the worst kind of cowardice. It's a bad boss. It's a boss that looks to kind of both sides it. It's the boss who does nothing, crosses his fingers, and hope things work out for the best. And White has been extremely lucky so far. But sooner or later, that luck is going to run out. And when people are coming around looking for someone to blame, Dana White's going to be the only one for letting things get this out of hand. There's a line somewhere. I think it's been crossed many times. I think this crossed it. I think Conor McGregor's talk of Habib's father crossed it. I thought Conor McGregor's talk of Habib's religion crossed it. I thought Chael Sonnen crossed it many times when his xenophobia was questionable at best. I thought McGregor crossed it when he said that he was going to ride into Aldo's favela I think all those things crossed the line where the UFC should have stepped in and but did nothing. So there is no line. So we'll see. Sooner or later, someone's going to say something that the people that Dana White answers to don't find so lighthearted, and White's going to be called on it. And he's going to have no defense because he's let it get this bad. So we'll see where this goes. It's probably nowhere good. Hamzat Chimaev returned to action after more than a year off at UFC 267, and I had some questions about his fitness heading into the event, and I think those questions were justified before the event, and yeah, he definitely answered them during the event, but still, I think they were justified before the event, because let's not forget, he spent a long time recovering from COVID-19. He said that he had at one point coughed up blood. He tried to retire from the sport because of how severe his issues were with COVID-19. And he said he was afraid he was going to die from it. So, yeah, to say that there were concerns about his health and his recovery, I think those concerns needed to be addressed. I don't think the UFC addressed them with medical tests, but I think from what I saw at UFC 267, I'm satisfied that he can compete at a high level, and that there was no, I mean, from a layman's perspective, there was no residual effects from the COVID-19 that he dealt with, which, again, very severe, very concerning, but just maybe he had never been, you know, that kind of sick. Not that many of us get that kind of sick, but he seems to have recovered well. And I mean, when he came in heavy and then tried to cheat on the scale, that didn't help. That didn't help to alleviate my concerns about his fitness. But when the fight started and he went right for that takedown and lifted Lai Jingliang over his shoulder and carried him to where Dana White was, just so he could have a conversation with White before he put him on the mat and just dominated him. Well, that answered my questions about his fitness level. It also answered some questions about where he stands in the UFC's welterweight division, because let's not forget, Jingliang was ranked and he was he's no slouch. So he was ranked number 11 before this fight. I expect Chimaev to be maybe land in the top 10 after his pummeling and choke out submission of Jingliang at UFC 267. So now he is 4-0. He has 4 fight night bonuses, 4 stoppage wins, and still has not gone past the second round. So let's look at the stats he's accumulated during that time. He has 2 submissions and 2 knockouts. 3 of his wins have come in the first round. His quickest win was 17 seconds against Gerald Marshart. His longest fight was his UFC debut, which made it until 112 of the second round. He's landed 4 takedowns, attempted 5 submissions, landed 112 significant strikes out of 145 attempted significant strikes for a landing rate of 77%, which, if he was eligible to be in the UFC record book, and you need to have 5 UFC fights to be eligible to be in the UFC record book, if he was in at 77%, he would be number 1 in significant strikes landed percentage. And I think he would also end up in there either number 1 or very close to number 1 at strikes landed per minute. And I'm going to guess, without looking, that his striking differential would probably be near the top 2. But definitely would be in there for the landing rate of 77%. I think Overeem is currently number 1 at 72%. So, no slouch. But as someone pointed out to me, I think Paul Giff pointed out to me on Twitter, it's not that hard to rack up significant strikes when you're postured up on the ground and just pelting someone. So, I mean, good point, but you got to get there first, then you got to get to mount, and then you just got to tee off. And significant strikes on the ground are not are counted a little differently than significant strike standing. There's got to be a lot of torque to a significant strike on the ground. The body's got to turn into it, or it's got to be a really strong strike from like a hammer fist or something like that. Just little punches without windups do not count as significant strikes on the ground. So significant strikes on the ground are fairly significant to get registered as such. So keep that in mind as well. So back to his stats. So he's been in 12 minutes, 12:39, I think, is his total time in those four fights. And his opponents in the UFC have only attempted four significant strikes, and they've landed, I think, one. So everything we see from Khamzat Chimaev, again, have we seen everything we need to see? Probably not. But everything we have seen says this guy is, if not championship material, definitely title challenger material. And with that, it's hard to say that when UFC 268, when the main event wraps up at UFC 268, it's hard to say that Kamaru Usman or Colby Covington or whoever wins that fight would be out of line to call out Khamzat Chimaev for a title fight. It might sound crazy, but when you think about it, if you're the champion, you probably want to face this guy sooner rather than later, because he's not going to get worse. He's 27. He's fantastic from what we've seen, and we haven't seen anything that would lead us to believe that he's got an issue anywhere. And so better to challenge to get him in the cage with you for a title fight now than for him to get a slight disadvantage exposed, but he can still win with that disadvantage and then fix it. You want to get him in when he hasn't figured out his weak spots, and that you and maybe your team can pick that weak spot out during the fight and then exploit it. You want that to happen as soon as you can. You don't want this guy getting any better before he challenges you for the title. You want to put him in there as soon as you can before he keeps getting better and better and better. And then you got a real problem. And I think you got a pretty big problem right now. But that problem's only going to get worse. He's only 27. He's just going to get better. So not out of line to say, you know what, I want this guy. And then, you know, you make it sound like the UFC's pumping his tires, because they're going to be. And Dana White was before he got COVID-19. You want to say, all right, you think this guy's the next big thing? Give him a title fight now. And then it plays into the hype that he's got built, that he's building. I think the UFC would probably award that fight to him because he's going to want it. And you strike while the iron's hot. And if you're the champion, you beat him. Well, then you got bragging rights. And then he's, you know, going to come back, I'm sure, at 27. He's not just going to quit. So it sets up a lot of interesting things. And if I'm the champ, I have Khamzat Chimaev's name in my mouth after UFC 268 for sure. Will that happen? I don't know. But like I said, you want to fight him now. You don't want to fight him in a couple years. Post-fight questions. And we're going to start off with something that happened before the fights. And that was that Khamzat Chimaev tried to cheat on the scale. Well, he did cheat on the scale because he kind of got caught and then got called back in. So he missed weight on his first try, came back, did the old hands on the towel, push down move. Didn't have his pressure dialed in quite right for the proper amount of cheating he needed. And therefore he came in, I think, at 166, which caused him to have to come back and weigh in with his hands over his head, which obviously should have been the right call to begin with, and he made weight. So I'm kind of along the line, I think, always think along the lines of, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. And I give him points for trying here, but he got caught, and there should be some repercussions. Now, should there be repercussions for Chimaev? I don't know, because he did make weight. But he did try and cheat. So obviously, when a fighter steps up to the scale and has the towel out, the hands need to immediately go above the head so there can be no shenanigans. And if a fighter does try and cheat and gets caught, well, from now on, maybe the athletic commission administers some kind of punishment. But for now, you know, this is one of those where the rules aren't really clear, and so you have to change the rules for the situation. And I think the rules should be changed for the situation, in that if you get caught trying to cheat on the scale, you should surrender a little more of your pay to your opponent, because you're trying to get over. And if you succeed, okay, but if you get caught, there should be repercussions. The UFC 265 pay-per-view plan, which was to offer the UFC 265 not as a pay-per-view, but as something that was included with the ESPN Plus package, was a wise one, I think. I don't really know all the ins and outs of why it was. Maybe it was because the UFC wanted to have a primetime show for the European market. Maybe it was because, and I think there was a little combination of these, maybe it was because the UFC wanted to try and offer this up for free, quote-unquote free, a stacked card that could be appealing to a lot of people. You throw that out there and say, well, you can have this one for the cost of your ESPN Plus subscription. Maybe the thinking was you get people in to the ESPN Plus subscription with this broadcast of 267, and then you load that broadcast up with previews for 268 and hope that, one, it gets more subscriptions to ESPN Plus, and two, it converts those ESPN Plus subscriptions to pay-per-view buys the following week. I kind of think that was one of the reasons that the UFC did this and ESPN did this, and I admire that, and I think that was a smart move. Did it work? That's my question. And if it did work, is this going to be something we see going forward? And I think it will be. If it worked and it converted, if it picked up subscriptions and it converts subscriptions to pay-per-view buys next week, I think this is something we'll see more of. Maybe not more than once a year, but let's face it, the ESPN Plus deal is get subscriptions and retain subscriptions, and the UFC wants to then turn those subscriptions into pay-per-view buys. If you see a flattening of those numbers, well, then you need to try and boost those numbers, and this is how one way the UFC and ESPN can try and make that happen. So we'll see. I will be very interested in seeing how it works out. The refereeing situation, and I'm not going to really discuss it because everyone saw how bad the refereeing situation was in that fight where it went on way too long. The thing I want to discuss is that the UFC was the commission in Abu Dhabi, and therefore the UFC was ultimately responsible for what the referee did, because one of the responsibilities of the commissions is to ensure health and safety. Now, the UFC is supposed to ensure health and safety as the promotion, and that it's supposed to also ensure health and safety as the commission in this case. So ultimately, everything I think boils down to what the UFC did or didn't do. I like the fact that he was removed and not allowed to referee again, but there's a lot of questions here now. And the questions are, the referee failed in many ways when he let this fight continue and didn't call a doctor in after the eye poke. The corner failed by not throwing in a towel, absolutely should have. And then now the question becomes, what could the commission do? What can the commission do? What can, and in this part, the promotion do to better care for the fighters? Now, the sport's inherently dangerous. There's no need to make it more dangerous. And that's what happened at UFC 267. It was made more dangerous by a referee who did not act. Now, is there something that is in the rules or could be written into the rules where the outside official or officials could step in and say that's enough and outweigh the referee that's in the cage? Now, I know there's going to be some kind of hurt feelings in that, but maybe tough shit. Is there some way that the commission could use the outside the cage physicians to say that's enough, call this fight off? Perhaps that should be explored. Can the promotion get involved in some way? Perhaps that should be explored. So what we saw on Saturday was that what we have in place right now, which is relying on the referee in the cage, who might not be as good as he should be, the corner, who might not want to throw in the towel for some ridiculous reason, failed. And the failure led to putting a fighter in danger. And therefore, something has to change. And we need to start to explore what can be changed. Saw three future champs fight at UFC 267, and I just want to briefly discuss them. Khamzat Chimaev, I think that if you're the welterweight champion, you challenge him sooner rather than later, and you hope that you beat him, and then you hope that you beat him soundly enough that he has to build up a lot more fights and a lot more wins to get another title shot, because he's young and he's only going to get better. And you want to get him out of the way and not have to deal with him if you're the champion now. You don't want him to get better. You just don't want that. That's a bad, bad move. Ankalaev, he was the number 7 light heavyweight going into this fight. So he might be a fight or two away from a title fight. Out of the three people I'm going to discuss here, he might be the one that's going to have the hardest time getting a title fight or getting a title right now. Now he's young and he has plenty of time to develop into the light heavyweight division, which we know one is shallow and two, you can fight a little longer. I think his biggest detriment right now is that he doesn't lead as much as he should. If he makes a few little tweaks to his style, I think he'll be an enormous problem. He's a pretty big problem right now, but if he changes things up and becomes a little more aggressive, he becomes an enormous problem. And like I said, he's young enough where he is going to be a problem for a long while in the division. Makhachev is fighting in the most stacked division in the UFC at lightweight, so he's in a weird spot. He probably should fight the winner of the Chandler and Gaethje fight, and then the winner of that fight should fight the winner of the Oliveira and Poirier fight. I think that lines up perfectly, or as close to perfect as we can hope, and I think that works out well for everyone. But and then we have Petr Yan, who of course beat Sandhagen, and I think beats Aljamain Sterling when they fight to unify the titles. So the argument here that we could have four Russian champions in 2021 or 22 during that time frame, I can't see a reason to think that there is not going to be more than one Russian champion from this group of four fighters in 2022. And it might go 4-for-4. I would not be surprised. There's nothing that I can say that would make me, or there's nothing that would make me believe that these fighters are not future champions. So this was a good card, if you weren't familiar, to get familiar with those fighters. So two quick ones here, just to wrap it up. Did you miss Joe Rogan? No, you did not miss Joe Rogan. Now, I know he doesn't do international pay-per-views, but now this is three pay-per-view events in a row where you didn't have Joe Rogan. And I say, just keep rolling along without Joe Rogan. You don't need him. The money that he sucks up could be better spent elsewhere. And Paul Felder is a better person for the job right now. Sorry, but Joe Rogan's time has come and gone. And it's now Paul Felder or Michael Bisping's time. So no, you did not miss Joe Rogan. And finally, did you tear up a little bit when Glover Teixeira won the belt? And if you did, that's all right. And if you didn't, I kind of have questions about what kind of person you are, because you probably should at least, you know, got a little misty when 42-year-old Glover Teixeira submitted Jan Błachowicz to become the UFC light heavyweight champion. Dude's been doing it a long time. He's one of the quote-unquote good guys of MMA. You never hear anybody say anything bad about Teixeira, and he's 42, and this was his last chance to get a title, and boy, did he deliver. So good on Glover Teixeira.